us have it.
Welcome again, folks, to Frame of Reference. Be coming together.
That's right. We should have, you should do, like, you were a DJ at one point, Antoine. We should have you do the coming together. You know that whole thing? What would that sound like if you were DJing this show? So.
All right, everybody. Welcome to a Frame of Reference coming together, y'all. I am Antoine Hallman, senior with Raul LaBruche.
It's LaBruche, man. How long have we... LaBruche, like fresh. Well, that's okay. People have done worse, I can tell you that much. So,
my bad, man.
No, it's my bad, too. I don't know what I'm talking about. So... Anywho, yeah, that's what we need. We know that, Soul Train kind of feel or something. I don't know. But,
just natural and real, that's all.
Yeah, there you go. Natural, I like that. Natural, real. You make me feel like a natural, real. There we go. So,
natural and real.
Yeah. So what's going on this week? This was a your week, right? Antoine, you were picking the topic for today.
Yeah, and I just was hoping that we can talk about, at what age do white kids learn about financial disciplines versus black kids learn about the financial disciplines and, say financial independence, financial responsibility? At what age is that taught in the house, or when do they really start to learn? Because, I believe that there is a disparity it starts way down, and it starts a long time ago. Of course, it's geographic first, and then, but of course, with the kids, when do they learn about financial responsibility, retirement, credit, and investments? When do they learn about these things? And that was a question that kind of stirred in me, because just to be honest, it's like I really didn't get a true grasp of this until my late 20s, early 30s, and it was like, and then of course, then you have this how do I say, you have a feeling of less than, because like, wow, here I am just learning what most of the world already knew. Yep. And so it's like, what can we do to make it so where other kids don't feel like that?
Right. Yeah. I'm kind of probably a bad example. I don't know. I was a baby in my family. Right, the last of eight kids, and I think partly because of that, and partly because I was always, I was so artsy fartsy and out there in the clouds and having a good time, and I did not learn good financial management. I confess to being a really, really bad money manager. I mean, to me, it was. And maybe this is part of the problem is I just never worried too much about money, and it's only been in the past, probably 10 years that I've always kind of understood money. But I between the fact that my wife and I struggled a lot through a lot of our marriage and just making ends meet, she was home raising kids and wanted to do that. She wanted to be that mom that was with the kids all through their growing up years. And then she got, pretty ill and, ended up not being able to return to work when she probably would have. So we've struggled for a lot of years. And I guess in some ways that has maybe made me a better financial manager, at least, knowing how to do without. But at the same point, Ann will be the first one to tell you that I'm the one that, I'll buy some, Star Trek doodad for myself because I'm a big Trekkie and, think nothing of, well, I work hard. I deserve that thing or whatever it is. And she's like the last person to spend any money on herself. So, we have that that dynamic going on, which is, she's the adult and I'm the kid. With how we approach that. And it's only been in the last few years that, now that I'm in the ripe old age of 62, where I have to stop and think, there ain't a lot of time to be goofing around anymore. So it's time to get real. It's time to, sit up straight and fly right. So, I'm, teaching myself about stuff, but it's just not... I was thinking about it that I had that I think I had that freedom and to be irresponsible, which I don't think is the same, you know, for kids that are, it can't be the same for kids that are coming from, you know, a background of poverty or from an area where there just aren't opportunities. I was able to, I had a graduate professor who used to talk about the operable illusion, and I had an operable illusion that money was going to take care of itself for me. You know, I would become a college professor, or, you know, I would, you know, have an opportunity somewhere, and, you know, things kind of work out. I mean, they did, at least in my case, that, you know, God had a plan, and it seems like I was able to follow that to a large extent, regardless of whether or not I was thinking about it. He just kind of led me along by my nose. By grace of God, I, you know, didn't end up losing everything. But that, you know, that mindlessness, not being mindful, you know, people don't like the term, but I think that was a function of my white privilege.
Let me ask you this. At what age did you start talking to your daughter and your son about money?
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't know. I don't know that I've ever really had a talk with them about it, honestly, because I've always, I mean, for most of the time the kids are growing up, I was working, you know, at least two jobs, sometimes three and four jobs. And so what I probably was teaching them more than anything about money is you have to work for it. But, you know, it wasn't through anything I said. And, you know, I maybe, you know, I should have asked Ann before we did this this podcast whether or not she had those talks. I know they were, you know, in our school system, at least they had a class you took either your junior or senior year, and it was basically, you know, basic economics, you know, of how you balance a checkbook and, you know, the kind of day in, day out financial things that a normal person has to deal with, and looking at, you know, the time cash value, whatever, of money. And so, but we didn't, I don't remember my dad having a talk. Mom used to talk about a lot of things, and the only thing she ever said about finances was we never knew anything about it. I mean, I never knew, just knew that they were working, but Mom used to talk about how Dad would tell her, you know, I don't really care. You know, manage the finances. Just don't go into debt. You know, they grew up during the Depression, so they knew what it was to go without. You know, they both came from really modest, you know, and are from their perspective, poor background, you know, kind of just struggling to put food on the table kind of deal.
But, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, because I know when it comes to, like, say, and the reason I ask this question, because, you know, it's like I have talked to, you know, various people, and they'll be like, oh, yeah, it's like, you know, my, like, I'll talk to a white, we'll be sitting talking with a white couple. Yes, the child, we have a bank account for the kid. He's 4 years old. And it's like, and I'm like, really? How and why? It's like, yeah, when he is of age, he will have had a 20-year relationship with the bank. And it's like, whoa, who? It's like, who would have thought of that? Well, it's like, is those kind of things that's being taught. Yeah. And that's what I was talking about. But I know when it comes to economic disparities and things like that, it's geographical. It transcends race. You know what I mean? It's just, it's class. You know, because I know, like, we talk about, like, say, the Sauk County area is a lot of rural areas. And people are, regardless of your race, you're affected the same. And it's like, but what, how and when is this financial responsibility being taught,
right?
You know, but I can tell you, like, say, you, I know you were saying, like, your family, y'all had to work for everything you got. Where were y'all? Were y'all always in the Sauk County area?
No, I grew up in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee, you know, okay, in
south side of Milwaukee. My mom and dad were both from small towns in upper Wisconsin, upper Michigan, and, you know, the border of Wisconsin. Mom grew up in Marinette, Wisconsin. Dad grew up in Menominee, Michigan. So literally right over the border, the state border from one another, both small towns. My dad's dad was actually, came from a very affluent family. Mom used to talk about him dad too, that he came down from Canada, and sort of the black sheep, you know, he left a pretty wealthy background. They used to talk about him having a valet when he was a kid. Then decided at some point he wanted to break out on his own and came down to Michigan and was a lumberjack, you know, basically worked in the lumber industry. So at that point he kind of forfeited everything, you know, to be able to just be his own person. And mom, on the other hand, she grew up in Marinette, Wisconsin. Her dad was a painter, and, you know, did a lot of, he actually was a wallpaper painter kind of guy, but he also did gold leaf work, which, like the churches would hire him for their, you know, fancy gold, you know, altar pieces or whatever. And what became, pretty kind of famous for that. I mean, it was a specialty thing for him, that there are some really big churches in Milwaukee that he did the gold leaf work on. So, I mean, but, you know, neither one. Grandpa LaBrèche died in 1931. So grandma then raised the kids through the Depression and, you know, had to scrape, do sewing, you know, whatever to put ends together and raise a family without them starving. But that's back in the day when, you know, you had chickens in your backyard, you know, and you grew your own vegetables. And so there wasn't a lot of pressure that way, but you know, they both had big families too. I think my dad had 12 kids or something in his family, and mom had about 9 or 10, you know, big Catholic families, gotta populate that world of ours. So, so there was hardship because of that, right? Having so many kids. But I guess I have to back up a little bit too with my son. He actually is much more like his mom, wants to save money. My daughter on the other hand is more like me. She doesn't really think about.
So the behavior was seen. It was seen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's been enacted in ways that, you know, like I wish I could go back and, you know, redo some of that, because I'm, you know, my daughter is much more example. She was at, Barnes and Noble a few months back with a friend of hers, and they had this game, the Princess Bride game, board game kind of thing. And Princess Bride has always been a kind of a favorite movie of ours. And, you know, we quote things from it all the time. But so she sees this game and is like, I have to have that. Well, it's like $80 for the game, you know, and I'm like, you know, it's not going to make or break us. But, you know, that's a thing I would do. You know, that was totally a dad thing that. You know, I was the one that was blah, blah, blah. Josiah, on the other hand, is like, he has to buy clothes for work. And he's like, I'll get by with this pair of pants for a while longer, you know, or I'll just get one pair of pants, not two or whatever. So we did, Josiah and Elizabeth both, we did set up savings accounts for them when they were like in their teens and help them with that. But really, Anne's dad was the one that was a caretaker and the, you know, teaching them to make wise investments and that kind of stuff, I guess.
Yeah, but I heard that when that one couple said they had bank accounts for their kids at the age of 4 or something like that, that just blew my mind. Yeah. And of course, the explanation of it was, you know, hey, yeah, it's like when by the time they reach a certain age, they will have had a 20-plus-year relationship with that bank, thus making them more credit worthy and all these different kind of things. Right. And it was amazing to me. And of course, I was like, wow, who's teaching kids of color or even low-income white kids, that who's teaching them that? Where is it being taught? Right. You know, like you say, some schools now, they may have a financial education course or, like you say, like a basic home economics or something like that, kind of course that'll give you a little gloss over. But it's like, really, when it comes down to like the things of saving and things like that, investing, life insurance, retirement, all those different kind of managing credit, all those different kind of things, it's like, where is that, you know, really, where is the knuckles kind of meeting the face for real with that? Because, you know, that is so much needed now, of course. And when we talk about, you know, when it depending on the geography of the family, right, you know, of course, they're going to all they see is poverty on top of poverty on top of poverty. And it ain't And like you were saying, like you gave a great example how, you know, your son, he saw this behavior of saving and being frugal, you know, but when you look at these kids in these other areas, you know, what they see is survival instinct. How is, okay, tonight we haven't, you know, it's 6 o'clock at night. We had powdered eggs and rice for breakfast. Now we're going to have PB&J for dinner. Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's not the last thing a person is thinking about is saving money. They're thinking right. about what we're going to eat next.
Right.
And, right. but it's like, you know, even in the midst of that, how can, you know, what can be done to bring this kind of financial education to kids of color or low income white kids? Now, I know my wife, she has a program called Shine, and that's is designed to bring up young women, young teen girls of color. And I have a program that we're working on called MITE, Men Ignited Growing Higher Together. Again, it's talking about changing the trajectory of family trees, so to speak, you know, right. just teaching them these things. But, you know, it's like these things, you know, these basic things, you know, it's like it's almost like sometimes I'm just going to tell you this, like it sometimes it feel like there's secrets in this world that ain't being shared. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's how I feel. Yeah. You know, of course, like it feels yeah. like that. And, you know, then, of course, later in my life now, it's like I was looking up some things and, you know, I came across UW People's Program and I'm like, how many kids of color know about this program? Are you familiar with UW People's Program?
I'm not.
Well, basically, it's kids are recruited in like 6th and 8th grade, right? Okay. And if they maintain a certain grade point average through high school graduation, they can receive scholarships for college tuition in the UW school system.
Okay, cool.
But it's like I don't believe that this program is being promoted.
Sure.
And also, like you learn it like in certain high schools where you can graduate like a Baraboo High School with an associate's degree, but how many kids of color are aware of this program?
Right, right.
It'll allow them to get ahead a little bit.
You kind of wonder sometimes if these are like marketing ploys or real practical ploys, right? It's like, you know, we want
a combination of both.
Yeah. We want to tell people we got this program so we look really, really cool and, you know, open-minded, whatever, inclusive, but we don't want to tell anybody about it because it might actually cost us something then. So,
well, I think this should be on the top of the tongue of every middle school teacher when they're talking with parents of color. Hey, are you aware of this program?
Right.
That should be one of the first things out of their mouth. Right. And even like freshmen going into Baraboo High School or whatever high school that has that program where you can graduate high school with an associate's degree.
Right.
These things should be on the top of the tongue. But when my wife was talking with some kids there, no one knew of this. And it's like, why don't they know of it?
Right.
And that was a kind of a bothersome point. But it just, you know, it's like, when do we start, you know, teaching kids about, you know, the financial responsibility and what it's going to take to build wealth? Well, a lot of people may not be able to ever have a chance to necessarily build wealth, but a good life, you know, a good responsible life.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the more wealth you build, the more options you have, right? I mean, that's what it comes down to. And, you know, for years, at least in my world growing up, I was one of two kids in my family, my brothers and sisters, that went on to college, you know? And it was weird because both, I guess my other brother actually did do some like an associate's degree or something of that nature, if I remember right. But both those brothers that I think didn't quite get bachelor's degree level or beyond were, they're both dead now. So I can't ask them. So, but my one brother that is still alive, he and I are also the only ones that got master's degrees. So, mm-hmm. you know, and both of that was, I know, a source of real blessing for my mom and my dad in particular, that, you know, his kids were able to get that far in school beyond what he had done. But, you know, we don't even think about the options that gives you. If, you know, you're absolutely right. These kids that should be made aware of these programs because they do give you the opportunity to earn more just because you've got that degree. It may not be, I mean, I got a theater degree, for goodness sakes. I'm not doing theater professionally, but having that master's degree does, you know, increase what you can handle, I think, or, you know, how you're marketable to people.
Yeah, but also, like, with the knowledge of these programs, you know, of course, like, say, kids of color and low-income white kids, they can actually minimize the amount of debt they accrue in college, you know, trying to pay their way through college via student loans and things like that. Or if you can graduate from high school with an associate degree, you're only paying for 2 years of college, if no, based on the transferability of the credits and so on and so forth. But just, again, just the gap, the imbalance. You know, there's just some things that I think we just, again, bridging the gap on these things. And again, we're not just talking about kids of color, but just low-income white kids. Because when you, again, coming from where we are in Sauk, you see it all over. You know, you got a good few that are doing okay, and then you got some that are not.
You know, that kind of leads into something that I think feeds into a lot of this. You know, whenever... let's take the current student loan forgiveness program, right? That President Biden wants to, is trying to get through. And, you know, interestingly enough, Republican judges and Republican districts are the ones that are fighting it, right? So it's the classic, you know, the Democrats want to give away everything and the Republicans are trying to protect the finances of, you know, the greater good. And when you listen to people talk about that, I've had, you know, quite a few people saying, you know, well, they should have to pay back their loans like everybody else does. And my counter argument to that is, hey, you know, this is one of the few times that I can remember where normal people, regular folk, you know, that kids that worked hard to either go through school or had parents that were helping them. We're not talking about the upper level here, the 125,000 plus crowd. We're talking about the kids that are, you know, struggling to get it together after getting their degrees or whatever. And you're going to say you don't want them to get that because you didn't get it. Whereas, but we just take it when they talk about an $800 billion bailout of the banks, right? Back in 2008. So, and those guys took that money and, you know, right away gave themselves the bonuses that they had been planning for. They took their retreats to, you know, uncharted islands or whatever, wherever they wanted to go. So, and we're just like, yeah, that's the way it is. But here's a chance to do something for, you know, some quote unquote normal folks, and we're fighting it. So I say all that because it seems to me that whenever you try to give somebody that could use a hand up, there's always people that are saying, well, where's my hand up? No one ever did that for me. So when you talk about programs for kids of color and, you know, poor white kids, you've got this group of folks that are sitting there going, well, where's mine? Where's my piece of the pie?
And see, and then again, that's a part of, like we talked about a couple weeks ago, about controlling the narrative. Again, when you take away, because again, this thing is historic, it's systemic and systematic, right? Yeah. And so it's like this has happened hundreds of years ago, this disparity, this discrepancy, this inequality, this gap that has been just is increasingly getting wider. It's been done hundreds of years ago. Of course, people say, well, you just have to put on your lace up your boots and go to work. It's like a person would go to work if they were living close to a area where there was jobs, if they had the means of transportation, if there was some type of form of training available to them. But again, like say, we were in Chicago at a prayer conference this weekend. Well, we were in Tinley Park, but, you know, whenever I'm in that area, I always take my wife through my old stomping grounds and just point to her where these projects used to be and what it was like. And I tell her the same story every time we go down there. But again, it's just like these things is like. I'm just going to say it. These things are deliberate. To me, it's like this unevenness, this disproportionness, this similitude is deliberate. And like you said, people are voting against giving $10,000 in student loan relief. You know, do you know it's like people are voting against their own best interest in that?
Yeah.
You know, because again, it's not just about kids of color. It's rural white kids. Mm-hmm. They need that hand up too. And it just blows my mind that, you know, people will vote against their own best interest to keep another group in its place. But the thing is, is like this is where I'm, I guess what I was, the question I was trying to, you know, go with today is just how can we, you know, I know my wife and I, we're trying to do our part and we're going to be reaching out to people to help us in this, this challenge, this cause, to help us educate and give understanding to kids of color and kids of the low income white community, mm-hmm. give them this knowledge while they're young, while before they end up in a, before they perpetuate the continuous cycle. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, if I'm hungry, you know, if what was that? That I remember that movie Aladdin. Right.
Yeah.
And when he's running away from the guys and he's like, you got to eat to live. You got to steal to eat. Otherwise, we'd get along.
Otherwise, we'd get along. Yeah.
But that's where, and that's what we want to try to stop, you know. But it's like, again, it's like, I think it needs to be a hard turn in the schools, just making people aware of these programs. And even if, of course, like with these programs, with the kid has to maintain a certain GPA and all those kind of things. But if they are aware of it, it's something to shoot for, yeah. You know, because, you know, how do I say this? It's just like a lot of black kids, they want to, a lot of kids of color, they want to do good. They just need the exposure. You know, they just need that shot. It's just a lot of rural kids want to do better than what they see in their current household. They just need that shot. They just need that little bit of knowledge, that something that they can grasp that's tangible to them, some type of form of a habit or behavior that they can develop at a younger age and change the trajectory of their family.
Yeah.
Well, we need,
we need hope, you know, and I don't know how you get hope when you're being kicked all the time. You know, let's face it, poverty is a kick. It's, you know, a kick every day that you can't. Well, you know, the skill program that both of us went through, I remember one of the most impactful episodes or classes of that was the one on poverty in Sauk County. And at least in that day, we would do this exercise where we had to go to a food pantry in our area and go through. They had a kind of a special time for us to go through and get what a normal person going through the food pantry would get and then live on that food for, I think it was 3 days at that point. So we got a sense, a tangible sense of what it was like to be in that spectrum of folks where you're living off of places like the food pantry. And, you know, I remember one of the people in class making the comment of their group, they were actually able to go through when other people were going through, you know, people that really needed the services. And they made a comment about how, well, either these people are going through, you know, and they got their cell phones with them. What are they doing with cell phones when they're going, they have to go through, you know, a food pantry? They can't afford that. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe that cell phone is like the only thing they have in their life that makes them feel like they got a chance. They're a regular person. Maybe those fancy tennis shoes that they're wearing are the one thing that they know they can't afford them, but they got them because they felt like they weren't so poor by getting them. And, you know, trying to have that sense of, you know, here I am as, you know, a white guy saying that to this person and they're like oblivious to the nastiness of what they're thinking because these people had a phone or had, you know, fancy, you know, tennis shoes on. I can't afford those tennis shoes. I wouldn't be having a phone if I was going to the food pantry. It's like, you know,
well, the thing is, you know,
compassion.
You're exactly right. That compassion. Like I was, we were talking with a young lady from the Sauk County Public Health, and she was relaying how a certain town, well, Reesburg, how they treat people coming through the food pantry. They just are totally disrespectful to the people to the point they don't want to come back and ask for the help.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And again, it's like when you serve a meal, it has to be with love and compassion and with dignity. And of course, and that was the purpose of the free community meals that we do. It's like to lower that wall, because yes, let's face it, people like say people that are struggling, right? They know where resources are. And of course, but the thing is, a lot of people are afraid of institution. When you say, oh, go down to this building or that building, right away you think institution. And when you think institution, you think courthouse, you think jail, you think the city, county, but whatever. You know, and so, and the people are afraid of that, and there's a lot of distrust in that. And so it's like a free meal, from what we've seen, a hot meal served with love and dignity will lower the walls of a person. And then it's like they start to ask questions, and it's like, hey, how do you get to this and that? And it's like, well, that's that. And it's like, oh, I've been there before, but I, and it's like, well, I'll tell you what. With my wife and I and Minister Tanisha and a few others, we'd have to say, okay, let us go with you, or let us make the call for you. And they would do that. So that hot meal will usher them into the help that they need. Yeah. You know, but it takes a like you say, it's some humanity, it's some dignity required. And when it comes to those cell phones, I've signed up so many people for the free cell. No, you call them a Barack phone, but it's like I believe it's the Department of Human Services or something like that. But I've signed up so many help. A lot of people get signed up for the free cell phone. And of course, it went from the flip phone. Now they're a smartphone. They're older phones, but they are phones, because otherwise, how can you communicate with any? And how you have, if you don't have a phone today, you are cut off from the world, basically.
Well, and a landline is expensive, too. I mean, you know, who has a landline that has a cell phone? They don't even have them anymore.
Well, who going to be at home enough to answer the landline? If you ain't got no home, a landline ain't no good, you know?
Right.
But it's just like, you know, and when you're talking about the shoes, you know, yes, some people that are living in certain spaces or have a certain mentality, you have to do something to make yourself feel good. But again, that could be a part of full financial management. It could be, you know, it's like, hey, $100 pair of shoes, you know, if you got a place to live, that's a week's worth of groceries, you know. So, but again, these things have to be taught, you know, it goes way back beyond us, brother. It goes so far back. And then again, but if history is cut off, the narrative is created to where, oh, well, they just didn't want to do it. That's why they are where they are. And that's not the case. Exactly. And that becomes the narrative. And that's where I history is trying to, is a fight to cut off history.
And it's a fight to keep. I find it amazing that we keep talking about the narrative, but the narrative is always designed to pit us against one another. You know, there's, you got to kind of follow the money, I think, in the whole deal that I've read somewhere not too long ago, something like 8 people in the world control 40% of the world's wealth. 8 mm-hmm. people control 40% of the world's wealth. When you think about how in the world are we not seeing that and going, the battle isn't between blacks and whites. It isn't between, you know, the people that are, you know, getting a $10,000, you know, relief for their student loans and the people that, you know, have to pay their, you know, truck loan because, you know, or whatever loan they have and, you know, feel like, you know, why is anybody getting a break on a loan? I'm not getting a break on any of my loans. We get sidetracked by that being the battle that we fight rather than saying, well, wait a minute, you know, instead of that $900 billion, I think it was $900 billion that went to the banks to keep them from, you know, closing down right when President Obama took office. At that time, I remember thinking, what if they would have taken that money and said, see ya, banks, too bad for you, too bad, so sad, and instead disperse that money to everybody with a 15 to 30 year mortgage. You know, so we're wiping those all clean. You guys are, you know, it's taken care of, you know, and took care of, you know, rent for everybody for, you know, 5 years. I would bet there was enough money there to be able to handle that. Think what that would have done for the economy versus, you know, those few small, you know, institutions. You know, they're huge. That's why we couldn't let them fail. But, you know, that small group of people that got help, that always gets help. You know,
yeah, but like you said, they actually gave themselves some really nice bonuses. And what did the airline industry do? They went and bought their own stock back.
Yeah. Well, and Microsoft or somebody just Facebook just did that, I think, that where they sold a bunch of their stock. They got rid of a bunch of staff members, and then they bought a bunch of their stock back. You know, so it's like, okay, so they're just taking all the money that they're saving by putting people out of jobs, you know, and making themselves wealthier by purchasing back that stock, because that drives the price of the stock up, right? Mm-hmm. So you're like, why – and I blame the press as much as anything else. The press doesn't keep hammering those things home. You know, that would cause
you're
trouble.
Exactly right.
That would get us aligned to the right message in the right way, you know?
And I agree with you when you said it's not necessarily a black and white battle, but because, you know, again, it's like there's just a handful of people in the world that they desire to see things a certain way. And of course, you know, when you talk about, vote, people having the right to vote? No, you don't need the right to vote. No, because, you know, it's like people feel like they're losing the country. Yeah. No, you're not. But there's room for all of us to grow. Like that $900 billion, that could have fulfilled the 40-acre and a mule promise. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And then some. And then some. Right?
You know, but it's like, again, and it goes back to people. I'll say this. You know, when we talk about, like, say, people of color, low-income white people, there's no difference. And when you're talking to another group of people, you have to get them to understand there's no difference between you and me in their eyes.
Right. White trash.
There's no difference between you and me, a black guy, and you being a white male or woman. There's no difference between us in their eyes. Right. But that's why I say people will vote against their own best interests. They'll take a key. Like this is something like I saw the commercial the other day about the I don't know if you saw this, but about the guy sitting at home collecting welfare, and they're saying, I think they vote on question 3 on the ballot coming up to make it so where you have to work for welfare. And this is a perpetual problem, you know, because again, states get this money, right? And they're not distributing it. They make you jump through hoops to get it. Like, say you take a single mother of three. If she could work, she would. So you mean to tell me you're going to, it's like, if she don't get to this class or get to this place, she loses that benefit. And then it's like, okay, I'll do this thing. Are you going to provide the child care? Well, no, your benefit is not enough for that. And again, it keeps you in a perpetual cycle.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, when I saw that commercial, it made me think of Mississippi, because, you know, like that thing that Brett Favre is entwined in, where they took $77 million from the welfare system, built a volleyball court for the college, and then they did what they wanted to do with the rest. And again, it's like, the sad part is nobody is going to jail.
Yeah,
but again, that's a perpetual thing, because that happens all the time. And like with this vote on that one question, if people were to start voting yes, they have to work, that's going to get so many more people cut off of the system, and they will have no source of income.
Right.
And then what? You're trying to create a permanent lower class.
Yeah,
I believe that. Some of this stuff is by design, and it's kind of sickening. That's why, like, you know, we pray, you and I, we pray for, you know, like, Lord, touch the hearts of these people that are above us, touch the hearts of the leaders of this country. Lord, just help them to see us through your eyes. Lord, help them to love us and each other. But these things are deliberate and intentional, and they're designed to hurt.
Right.
And so that's why it's like we got to reach, you know, inner city, rural teens, and teach them about financial responsibility earliest possible, because they are going to be the difference in their family tree.
Well, I have a sister who buys hook, line, and sinker the whole line of, you know, these welfare moms, these welfare queens that get all this money just handed to them. And, you know, I mean, that's, I get it. You know, there may be, never met this person. There may be somebody out there that is exploiting this system. That's all the other possible.
I would say there is.
You know, there got to be, because if there's a way to beat a system, somebody will figure it out. But I always want to remind her, you know what? One of our sisters, my sister who just passed away not too long ago, she had AFDC, Aid for Dependent Children. aid for families with dependent children. So while her kids were growing up, she got welfare checks. So, and there was a certain stipend per month that she got because she had been in a relationship with a guy that fathered the three children she had, and he was abusive. So that, mm-hmm. you know, he had to go just, you know, and she was protecting the kids as long as she could, but he had to go. She was able to get herself free of the guy and then raise the kids herself. So, and she, but she never had anybody walking alongside her to plan for what about when this ends, what do you do? She never had a high school diploma. You know, she was the black sheep that, you know, got out of school when she was in ninth grade, got pregnant out of wedlock. So she gets, you know, saddled at 17 years of age with a kid and then another kid and then another kid. So she was set up, you know, really in a lot of ways to have a dependency upon the government for providing for her kids. And then when that was all done, when her, you know, the last kid turned 18, she didn't have any way to keep going. I mean, it's pretty sad when you have to take welfare, and if you got a job because of your status, she didn't have any education, she didn't even have a high school diploma. She was going to make far less if she took a job than she would if she, you know, kept on taking the welfare. So mm-hmm. I put this out to anybody out there listening. Who in their right mind would not do that for your kids? Who would not stay in a situation? So when you're talking about they should just go to work for a living, okay, what are you going to do? It's, to me, that's the same problem that kids on the south side of Chicago have. Should I sell crack and make, you know, $1,000+ a week? Whatever. I don't know what the going rate is for somebody that's just dealing. I don't do it, so I don't know. But I got to believe it's better than the $15 an hour you can make in Chicago working at a McDonald's. You know, and it's so how do you – my sister was in the same realm of that, where you're going to tell me that she should just get a job when her getting a job would have meant that she would have had less food to feed her kids than she had if she was on welfare. So let's take it a step back further, folks, and say, okay, so what are we going to do for these people that made bad choices? Yeah, I get it. They made bad choices. They're going to pay for their bad choices. But how long? Are they going to pay for their choices that way? Are they going to pay for their choices by becoming criminals, by stealing from other people? We're just perpetuating the nonsense.
Exactly. And they're relegated to a life of poverty. And like I say, with this thing that they're telling people to vote on, right?
Yeah.
Because again, like if you don't mind, I'm going to use your sister as an example.
Yeah.
Just say a single mom, few children. Hey, in order to continue to get this benefit, you have to do this. If you don't do this, we're taking it away.
Right.
And what do you do? And it's like, okay, that's why, you know, like I'm a proponent. Yes, there needs to be free childcare here. Yeah. You know, it should be, because I there's a lot of people that are on welfare or in less fortunate situations. They want to do better. They want to. But it's like, I can't. You know, of course, like you take like a Chicago or something like that, like all the jobs are primarily out. You know, they are outside of the city. You know, you have to take a train, and then the train only gets you to a certain point.
Right.
You know, it's like you're trying to work at Pepsi Cola or something like that. If you're on the south side of Chicago and you say, oh, Pepsi Cola is hiring at $20 an hour, I can't get there. You even look at Baraboo.
Right.
You look at it like when we go to the Reedsburg Business District. There are so many companies continuously hiring out there, but there's people that can't get there because there's no public transportation.
Right.
When I moved to Baraboo in 2011, there was public transportation. I was like, really, there's a bus here. And then I was like, this bus ride around this little town all day? They were like, no, it'll take you to Portage, Reedsburg, this and that and the other. And I was like, right. Oh, that's cool. But for whatever reason, it stopped.
Right.
But again, it's like, that type of thing right there is a city expense.
Right.
But I'm telling you, if the city was to pick up that expense again, it'll make people more self-sufficient. And then it'll lower some of the expenses that they actually have that they're paying out
right.
via welfare and things like that. But you just got to make a way.
Right.
You know, and yes, it's going to cost, like I say, a lot of people want to avoid the things that are happening because it's going to cost money to fix. People hate to hear equity.
Right.
Because that costs something.
Well,
Well, that's going to cause something.
And think about it for a second. I mean, that class, that month in skill where we did the poverty unit, one of the things we had to do was take a worksheet and figure out what a single person, a single mom or dad, whatever, could make working at a minimum or slightly above minimum wage, what they could make on a, you know, annual basis, a weekly basis, annual basis, whatever, and then start taking out all the expenses that person has. You know, take out the rent, take out the food, you know, take out the, if you have a car, the gas, the insurance. Remember, Wisconsin's a, you know, you got to have insurance, car insurance. Take all of those expenses. And consistently we found there was like a negative $1,100 a month difference between what you could do getting an honest living and what it costs to live. So here's my idea. Let's throw this out there, America. My idea is not taking welfare away from people that are working, but making a rule that says you can have this welfare and you have to work. And we're not going to take it away from you if you work. We're just going to give you enough welfare so that you're making above the poverty level for a person living in these United States. What would that do? You know, and then you're accomplishing both things. Because let me tell you, we have lots of jobs here where I work where people come in and want you just to sign the form that says they applied for a job so they can keep getting their, you know, their workers' comp, right? So don't talk to me about this being any other problem than the difference between the people that want to work and the people that don't want to work. Well, give them an incentive to work. Yeah, you can have this welfare. We'll give you welfare as long as you need it. But you got to have a job.
And the thing is, and again, it's like, again, if people were not fighting against infrastructure, because again, there's a lot of people that argue and fight against, you know, public transportation, like the Koch brothers. They have their hands in everything, automobiles, particularly they have their hands in rubber, which makes tires. So they say, hey, if people are catching the bus or the train, they're not driving cars, meaning they're not buying tires. So they are big proponents. They throw a lot of lobbyist money at politicians. So they vote against public transportation because, like, we should have, this place should be just as tight as a better as Japan, where you got a jet train that could take us from California to Chicago in a matter of hours. We could have this type of infrastructure, and like even breaking it down to the granular, like we're talking about in Salk, for instance.
Right.
If there was just some public transportation that can allow people to get to and from work. That'll just, oh man, that it'll do so much for a person's spirit, you know, just to make it on their own grit. And regardless of the mistake they made that put them in the position, and a lot of times there was no mistake made, you were born into it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and then you were born into the hopelessness and the poverty mindset. And so that's where shine and might and just I'm going to be dragging you into this too, so you know. But we raising these, really just teaching, you know, the youth financial responsibility and teaching them that, you know, and how to do this thing right. You know, of course, again, like I said, I guess the good Lord was keeping me even when I wasn't saved. Cause I mean, I was always good. I always worked. I always made good money. And even as a single dad, things didn't get bad for me until I broke my neck in 2008, but I saw how, man, Social Security was slow giving me that temporary help, but they cut it right back off. And I'm like, I still got this issue. They was like, nope. And then as I talked to other people, they like, I've been getting Social Security disability for 20 years now. And it's like,
why?
What's the difference between you? I got a broken neck and I just had a second surgery just in September. So why am I fighting this? And then it's like, the list goes on and on. Yeah. But we see how these chains can be broken. These perpetual systems can be broken. It requires people to vote. It requires people speaking out. And again, it's like things when it comes to welfare and things like that, those things can easily be eliminated if cities, towns, states, countries, or whatever, they're willing to spend the money. You know, it's like, you know, in the skill class, I believe they're saying like Baraboo is about to get a $50 million new building for the city tractors and trucks and all that.
Okay.
Hey, that's good. But $50 million in a small town of Baraboo, you mean to tell me that couldn't provide public transportation so people can get to and from various areas where there are jobs?
Right. Well, you know, let's talk about voting. We're going to have to talk about that. I think that's going to be our topic next week.
That's another. Okay? That's a whole other one.
Just, I'm throwing this out to America here, folks. Voting. why are we consistently bamboozled by politicians that spend all of their political capital, all of their advertising money, not on talking about what they're going to do? It has turned into nothing more than fear tactics for what is going to happen if you elect the other guy. Period.
Absolutely.
So my posit is, ask your politician, whoever you're thinking about, when there's a vote coming up, ask them each, what are you going to do for me? What are you going to do for people like me? That's what we ought to be voting for, because if you vote for people that are going to do right by Antoine, you'd vote for people that are going to do right by Raoul Labrouche. No, Labrèche. You vote for those folks, and I guarantee you it's going to help you. It's going to help, you know, people like you. And, you know, we for goodness sakes, we can't get a law passed by these folks we have put in office so far that says tax people, don't stop Social Security ever. I don't care how much money you earn, you're going to pay Social Security. We could wipe out the problem we have with Social Security running out in 2034 if we just said to everybody, you're paying that 6.5% or whatever the heck it is.
You're paying your fair share. Right? Yep.
I mean, come on. And why does that never get passed? Because we're electing politicians based on they're not Trump, they're not Biden. That's our litmus test. Or they're pro-abortion, pro-life, which I have no idea what that even means anymore. We're voting on that instead of voting on who do they care about? Whose pockets are they going to line?
Exactly. And see, and this is the thing. These politicians, they'll pick one issue or one issue per demographic and have a group of people like, say,
crime. Oh, crime's a big one right now.
Thinking of a county here. Like, say, let's just take Brown County, right?
Sure.
Like, they'll use that because you seen the commercial with the three sheriffs. Oh, the guy did this, that, and the other, and then he put it on Facebook. I'm like, I don't think you can do something so bad and then put it on Facebook. I think it'll be torn down. But anyway, it's just, you know, again, it's just like you'll take one subject matter and you'll point it at a certain demographic and you'll have them vote in one thing. Just like you can have a point crime at one thing.
Yeah.
You can point. Then of course you bring out your Bibles and point at another thing,
right?
You know, and that's where the education, and you know, we all need some kind of general political education and understanding that, okay, yeah, you say you'll do this thing, but what about the other thing? You know, right. How is that going to benefit me? Because I mean, right now, you know, it's like I have to vote one way by default.
Yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's by default. I have to vote one way. But it's like.
And it's voting against your own interests when it comes right down to it. Right. Right.
Yep.
That's the thing that's getting harder and harder. It's just like,
man, I'm looking forward to this conversation. The voting conversation. All right.
So you got a closing thing you want to say?
We really just need to. Social, economic, and financial disparities, they go beyond race. Again, we're talking about a better country, a better place to live. We just got to start educating people in finances, in politics, in just humanity as a whole. People just got to learn to love. And I think when we can really start to hit on those things, this country will be what it's supposed to be.
And I will point people towards, if you have not seen this, I think a genius thing that I saw years ago, and I've gone back and watched it a couple times. Go back and look on YouTube for a video from Saturday Night Live from years ago called Black Jeopardy. And Black Jeopardy with Tom Hanks. It's hilarious because it's who's the guy that he's been on there forever, but he's basically the Alex Trebek guy. And then there's two black people playing, two of the contestants, and then Tom Hanks is this big redneck playing alongside them. And it's absolutely brilliant because as they go through the game, and you got to watch it to see how wonderful this is, but as they go through the game, they come to realize that they care about the same things. They're getting screwed over by the same things. And, you know, you're this redneck and these, you know, people are like, they would never associate with a redneck. By the end of it, they're going, dude, that's what I'm saying too. You know, so we need to have more Black Jeopardy going on, I think, in our lives.
I'm going to find that clip.
Oh, it makes me laugh.
My social media.
Yeah, every time I see it, I just laugh because it's just brilliant. whoever wrote that skit, they need to write more skits just like that. So, because in that 5 minutes, they said more about racial and economic disparity than any, you know, economics professor could tell you. So, anyways, that's it, folks. Thanks for joining us again for another week of Frame of Reference coming together. We'll see you again. Your name is, what's that, your name again?
Antoine Hallman Sr.
And my name is Raul Boosh. So I'm going to keep kidding you about that for a while now, okay?
So, you're going to keep grilling me on that one forever.
LaBrush like fresh, Raul like Raul. It's really easy. I don't know why everybody can't get it right the first time.
LaBrush.
But I'm Raul LaBrush. We're so glad you joined us today. And please join us again next week here on 99.7 Max FM's Digital Network.